Welcome to the Get Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Liz McGavro, and I'm obsessed with all things writing, creativity, and telling your stories in your authentic voice, because I believe a good story can change the world. Ever since I was a little girl with my nose in a book, I dreamed of being an author. I wanted to see my books in bookstores everywhere. I wanted to talk about books. I wanted to soak up everything about the craft. My celebrity crushes were mostly authors, and I could feel in my bones that the writer's life was my destiny. Fast forward to today. Along with my alter ego, Kate Conti, I'm an Agatha Award-nominated best-selling author with 3 mystery series. But it wasn't all smooth sailing along the way. I experienced many setbacks, crushing self-doubt, a lot of career detours, and I even lost my voice a few times when I let the world get in my way. Until I learned that writing was so much more than just a skill set you learned and developed over time. It's also an inside job that flourishes when you heal all the wounds that are stifling your creativity, which is no easy task. So if you're a writer of any kind, or if you've always wanted to write but aren't sure where to start, this is the place for you, my friend. We're going to talk about all things writing process, craft, strategies to help you get writing and stay writing, the daunting world of agents, editors, and publishing. And because I'm using my authentic voice, I'm going to throw in a little woo-woo for you too. So let's get writing, shall we? I'm your host, Liz McGavro, and I've got my friend Carolyn Wilkins on the show today, and I think you're going to love her. Carolyn is a writer, a musician, and a psychic medium. So I got to meet her many years ago in the Boston mystery writing world, and she's a lovely person. She's a talented writer. I've used her services as a medium, and I can tell you she is the real deal. And now she's got a brand new series coming out soon about, you guessed it, a psychic medium. So I'm so looking forward to it. It's going to be so much fun. So in this episode, we talk about her transition from writing memoir to crafting murder mysteries, her journey to mediumship, and even more fun, the challenges of how to portray psychic experiences in fiction, which is a really fascinating topic. And of course, we cover the whole writing life from persistence to perfectionism to publishing. So we had a ton of fun, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Let's jump in. Hi, Carolyn. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. I've been looking forward to this conversation because I have so many things I want to talk to you about. Because I love what you do, and, you know, aside from writing, I love what you do, so I'm very curious and fascinated. So let's just start by telling everybody who you are, what you write, how you came to writing, all of those fun things.
Okay. So my name is Carolyn Marie Wilkins, and I do use my middle name in my books because I discovered there was another Carolyn Wilkins in Montreal who was like a banker or something, and she has all kind of books and videos out and everything.
Oh, wow.
So I had to kind of get clear about who was who. But I write several different things. When I first started writing, I wrote 2 memoirs about my family, which were a mix of African-American history and me searching for the truth about my grandfather, who was the first Black Assistant Secretary of Labor ever in 1954 under President Eisenhower, and who resigned fairly abruptly from his post. And so my quest was to find out the story. And of course, that led me to discovering more about my own story and about my family. So I wrote 1 book about him and 1 book about my mother's side of the family, and those women are all musicians. And so since I'm a musician, I thought, well, you know, I need to write about them and their story. So I did two books like that. I did a textbook because for many years I taught at Berklee College of Music in the ensemble department, helping singers and performers to work together in bands. And so I wrote a book about how to do that. And then I did what I really wanted to do, which was to write murder mysteries. I've always loved reading them. I'm fascinated. My whole family, we grew up with the Agatha Christies and the Lord Peter Wimsey and all of that kind of thing. And I just always thought it would be fun to do. And after writing two books basically about myself, I wanted to completely get away from that and write fiction. So I have written three murder mysteries. The first two that I wrote were about a, surprise, surprise, an African-American music teacher, this case on the south side of Chicago. I wrote two mysteries in which she was the protagonist. And then I went to my other interest, which is psychic work and spirituality in that way, sort of alternative spirituality. And I wrote a mystery about a woman in the 1920s who was a medium. And after writing those three books, I was lucky to acquire a new publisher. And so as a result of that, I'm now writing a new series, and sort of the theme of the series is psychics and soul food. And my protagonist, once again, is an African-American woman who's a psychic. It is once again set in the Midwest of the U.S. In the 1920s. But other than that, it's a totally different story and totally different feel. She's older, wiser, more sophisticated, but she solves mysteries. And so that's kind of what I'm doing now.
I love it. It's so diverse.
Well, there is that.
And I'm curious because I hear it from a lot of writers who, you know, say they've always wanted to write fiction of some sort. You know, for you and I, it's murder mystery. And, you know, it was after all the other things that they did in their life that they finally decided to do it. Why do we think that is? Like, why do we wait so long to do these things?
I think, well, in my case, I had had a whole other lifetime and career as a musician. That's what I trained in from the time I was 5 years old. I knew I wanted to be a musician. My mother is a music teacher. So I had that in my background. And when I went to college, it was for music. And actually, I started off as a percussionist. I was playing the drum set, and then I learned how to play percussion in the symphony. And I had a whole other lifetime as a orchestral percussionist. I lived in Singapore for a while, playing with the Singapore Symphony and so forth and so on. And then I began my teaching life as a music teacher. And that eventually led me to Berklee and to playing jazz piano, which I still do. But the point of that being that for a long time, and I do think we're kind of a little bit the victim of our education system, because I attended two very fine music conservatories, the best, but they told us that we could only, you know, that in order to be any good at music, we had to put aside other interests and only focus on that. And even down to a narrow type of music, even. which I think in this modern world is incorrect. And hopefully they've changed the way they look at that. But that's how I was taught. So for a long time, I thought, well, gee, much as I love writing, and when I was a kid, I used to write stories and little plays and so forth, I can't possibly do that and also pursue a career as a musician. And what really kind of convinced me that this was incorrect was that Berkeley asked me to write this textbook. And that's what actually started me on writing because, okay, that's safe. I'm already on the faculty. They need me to write a textbook. I'll write a textbook. But even, and you'll love this, even during the course of writing the textbook, the most fun part was making up the little stories and things that I used to introduce the exercises. The exercises actually was boring. That was just the same thing I was already teaching, but I could make up these little hypothetical stories. Imagine you're in the band with the blah, blah, blah. And that's when I realized, you know what? I really like writing. And my grandfather's story was really important to me, and I knew that if I didn't write it, whether I thought of myself as a writer or not, if I didn't write it, it would not be told because he's not so hugely famous that someone else is going to go through the things to dig it up. So that's what started me. And I think we do wait. And also, sometimes, as you know, writing takes so much time, so much effort, and so much energy. Sometimes we have to clear the decks a little bit. And I don't think it's an accident that I already had achieved, I don't want to say the pinnacle. Well, you know, I was pretty much maybe 25 years into my Berkeley career when I started writing. So I had already done a lot of stuff. I was already comfortable. I was already a full professor. I was, you know, I was at a place where I could say, okay, I'm ready to try something new. Yeah. So maybe that's why.
Yeah. It is interesting though. It's a little bit of a twist on the, you know, people who, for example, want to be writers or want to start writing young, and then they go into, you know, say finance, and then they're told that the finance job is the realistic job and the writing is not the realistic job. You were in already a creative type job and were being told that another type of creative, you know, endeavor was not acceptable. It's really interesting to me.
It's the way our society at least used to. I think students, I still teach, not as much, but I still teach. And I do think students today are far more open to doing different versatile things. First of all, it's gotten so nearly impossible to make a living as a musician that you need other thing. I mean, maybe you'll hit it big with your rock band, but most likely you'll also have to teach, or maybe you will also have to work in a store, or you'll also have to work for a company, or you'll. So I think students today accept this a lot more. When I was coming on way back in the billions of years ago, we were basically told, you know, you're being trained to be an orchestral musician, period. And your career path will be auditioning until you can get into a symphony. And if you don't do that, you've failed. And you're going to have to go back to school all over again to train for something else.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Yeah, so exactly. from a fiction perspective, you wrote your protagonists were a musician or a musical teacher, right, and then a medium. So which one, if one of them did, feel more comfortable to you? Because you're expert in both of these things, right? Which one came more easily to you?
Well, you know, that's a funny thing. I think I started with the music teacher. That was the first one. And really, to be honest, the character was not even so much based on me as it was an homage to my mother, who was also a music teacher and who actually did teach on the south side of Chicago in a community college. And she would come home and tell me her adventures, you know, with the students and with the neighborhood. And there were so many things going on in terms of the adverse nature of the neighborhood, the obstacles the students had to overcome and all that. And so I felt totally comfortable writing that. But after two books, to be honest, I just got bored. You know, I felt like, okay, I've done that. I understand. I could write another one. But on the other hand, wouldn't it be fun to try something different? And since I am also a psychic medium, I thought, well, that would be kind of a fun thing. And I chose the particular area of the country, which in this, psychic book was Southern Indiana. I chose there because both sides of my family in the 1920s had lived in Evansville, Indiana at one time. And I started to dig around and do research there. And I found it just a fascinating environment, you know. So then I moved to that. So to answer your question, I don't think one was more comfortable than the other. It was just the psychic one was an opportunity to try something different. So stretch, I think, a little bit more.
Yeah. Okay, so tell me about how you found your way to mediumship. I'm fascinated by this. I love mediums. I love real mediums like you. I had a reading with you a few years ago that helped me so immensely that I still talk about it.
Did.
Yeah.
Wow, I had almost forgotten that. It was like a long time ago. But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was so great. And you know, this is a topic that I actually need to talk more about, but it was with you had contacted for me. Well, my dad, who died like 9 years ago, ended up joining us in the reading. Oh, wow. But also the purpose of it was to I had an ex that had passed away like many, many, many years ago, back when I was in my very early 20s, and who I always felt was a presence in my life. Yeah. And I needed to understand why. And you brought me the answer that I had been looking for so long.
Now, I'll tell you what is really cool about that. Thank you. When I do mediumship, and I think if you talk to other mediums, you will find many of us, or even a psychic reading, once I've done it, I'm in the moment of doing it. But once it's done, it's done. It's gone. And I don't actually remember, even if you were to talk to me a day later or 2 days later, I wouldn't necessarily remember very many of the details, which I think is good. You know, it protects your privacy. But it's also because as mediums, we're not actually making the information happen. We are receiving the information. And if the contact is successful, the Carolyn is moved out of the way. And it's just sort of a conduit, and we're just more like a telephone wire or something to allow your father or your ex or whoever to come through, and we maybe interpret a little bit. But the better medium, the better of a medium that you are, the more out of the way you are. And that means that you really, not to say you're totally out of it, but you just don't hold on to it. And certainly after it's over, it's gone. But I'm glad to hear that it was helpful. So your question was, how did I get started with this, right? So I've always been psychic. Many of us are psychic. It's I think, an aspect of human nature to be psychic. And the only difference between people who call themselves psychic and maybe the rest of people is just the degree to which you are aware that this is what's taking place. And also, once you decide that you're going to cultivate it, it's just like music or writing. You start going to webinars, you start taking lessons, you study. Just like you might have known you were good with words, but I'm sure you also probably read some books or went to some classes to hone your chops, right? So in my case, around 2000, maybe 2008 or 2009, I had a beloved aunt, great aunt, who passed away. And I was very, very close to her. I always felt she was sort of the inspiration of, if I could be, you know, this is who I would like to be. She was an amazing woman. And when she passed away, it really made me realize how that veil between we're here and we're not here, but yet we're still here. And I started, I think, to pay more and more attention to that. And I just started receiving insights, or people would say, oh, you said that just the way Aunt Marjorie would have said that. Or you would, or I would find myself thinking of her. And I just got curious. I think it was something I'd always wanted to do. Once again, Liz, things that we wait until later in life to do. I think if I had done those kind of things as a teenager, it would have been very difficult. As a little kid, I heard voices and saw things all the time. But, you know, I was talked out of that because, you know, that was like, nah, you don't want to go there. And then as a teenager, you definitely don't want to go there. People are going to think you're weird. And that's the last thing you want, is to admit that you knew someone was going to do something or say something before they did it. So you suppress it. And then later, as I said, I was well established at Berkeley. I was married. My kid was already, you know, into her own teens. In other words, I was more sort of established as a human being to have greater confidence. And I just started being curious. I started getting readings from people. I went to a book fair, and I thought I was going to the book fair to go and see mystery writers, you know, Janet Evanovich or somebody who was talking, right? And I was going to go and see, and somehow I got detoured to go and see this other woman talk who was a psychic. And as she sat there, she didn't talk about her book. It was a terrible book talk. Just gave psychic readings for people. People kept asking her questions about the book, and instead she'd go, you know, you've been tired lately, haven't you? Yes. And sure enough, the whole thing, and I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. And I started sort of following her, you know how you do. And before you knew it, I was taking classes with her and reading her books. And then I discovered other mediums online and took their class. You know, you go deeper down the rabbit hole. And eventually, I studied with three very well-known mediums. James Van Praagh, who used to have his own TV show back in the day. I studied with him for a few years. And then I studied with a woman named Mavis Patilla, who she's passed on now, but she was sort of the doyen of British psychics. She was amazing and a very rigorous, very strict, very British teacher. And one thing about the British, as you probably know, they don't fool around. Not to generalize, maybe some British do, but all the ones I've met, they're very business. If class started at 9, you did not walk in at 9:01. In fact, she would ring a little bell. Class would begin. And yeah, but it was a wonderful education, and I studied with her for, I want to say, 2 years. And then I went to Arthur Findlay College, which is a famous school of mediumship over in England. And I met another very well-known psychic, Tony Stockwell. I studied with him. So long story short, I just got into this deep study of mediumship. And after spending maybe 3 or 4, maybe 5 years deep in that, I felt like, oh, okay, now I can say I'm a medium. And so I do offer psychic readings and mediumship. I don't do it a lot because I'm writing, right? But I do it, and I enjoy it. I think it's very satisfying and very healing, very healing.
Yeah, for sure. So when you're writing about mediumship, what do you think is the hardest part of, you know, because there are probably a lot of people who claim to be mediums who are not, and there's a lot of skepticism around the whole profession. Exactly. So how do you approach that in your writing so it's exactly. So people understand that it's a real thing?
Yes, and that is a thing because there's a lot of bogus stuff. There's a lot of, hucksterism. And the real people are often very much under the radar is what I'm trying to say, under the radar and low key. And they do not necessarily provide the razzle dazzle that one expects. Or even if you watch TV, you know, I used to be a big fan of the Long Island Medium, for example, and those people who are on TV and you know how they walk into the grocery store and boom, they get an insight and they're all over it in some random stranger in the grocery store. And the thing about those things is that they, although they make great television, they are not an accurate sense of how it's really done. And I think often when people come to you as a client, they have misplaced expectations because they've been watching these things and that. And genuine mediumship is a lot more hit or miss. There's a lot of dialogue back and forth. Well, I'm feeling the presence of this man. He looks like this. He has these habits. Do you recognize someone like that? Oh, sort of. And it's a back and forth. And this is not necessarily the most dramatic presentation. So for those of you listeners who are thinking about getting a mediumship reading, if the medium is more low key and it feels more like a sincere conversation, that might actually be getting something deeper than they immediately go in and start pronouncing, your grandmother told me this or that. And this is where the British, back to the British, they are very precise. The British mediums, they have a very precise standard. And so you're saying your grandmother, how do you know it's your grandmother? How do you know it's not a great aunt? How do you know it's not some random person? Describe her. What did she look like? What did she sound like? What were her habits? Ba 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 ba. So when I'm writing about mediums, however, going through all that back and forth and blah, blah, blah does not necessarily make for the best drama. So often in my stories, I have had to, the medium more just will receive a vision or go unconscious and start speaking in trance. Not that this is the most realistic or common, but because as a writer, it serves the plot. And as writers, we have to put the plot first. If I were writing a how-to book about mediumship, that would be a different book. But yeah, my characters, you know, they go into a trance and boom, lights appear. And that, we need drama. It's writing, you know.
Yeah, it's also fiction. It's also fiction. Exactly. So there is a little bit of that suspension of disbelief required.
You have to, and it has to move the plot forward, and you can't take 40 pages of back and forth dialogue to do that. But I do try, the thing that I have tried to do in my stories, particularly this new series that I have coming out, The Psychics and Soul Food, this is once again set in the southern Midwest. It's in southern Illinois. It's right down by the Mississippi River. So the town itself is partly southern, partly northern. It's during a boom time, but there's a lot of corruption. There's prohibition. There's lots of things. And it was also a time in the 1920s because people had just come out of the First World War, where so many young men had died just like that. There was a renewed interest in spirituality, and people, this is historical fact, people were going to mediums and doing things, including a lot of sketchy mediums that, you know, were kind of mumbo-jumboing things. There's a great context, and I do try, although some of the mediumship may be a little more flashy than I would probably do if you came to me, I do try to keep the history and the context accurate and respectful to the time and place, because that also gives the story attention of its own, because those times were very, very tense, particularly for African Americans. So I try to include some of that. Even if she's having visions and seeing lights, she has to come back to earth and deal with the nitty gritty of life as it was in those times.
Hi, this is Julian, the producer for the Get Writing Podcast. Zencastr is an extremely important part of our workflow on this show. Podcasting has you working with a wide range of people who all have different computer and office setups, different levels of comfort with technology, and different levels of time and patience. Zencastr takes this big logistical headache and makes it utterly trivial. No more grappling with recording software, waiting for files to be delivered, losing files, none of that. Log in using your browser and start recording a high-quality podcast right away. Record studio-quality sound and up to 4K video with your guests. Feel a sense of zen knowing Zencastr's multi-layered backups ensure you always have your recordings in the highest quality, even if the connection is unstable. If you've ever thought about podcasting and thought that you need a lot of different tools and services, those days are over. Zencastr is an all-in-one podcasting platform. You can create your show all in one place and then distribute it to Spotify, Apple, and all the other major destinations. Go to zencastr.com/pricing and use our code writing, and you'll get 30% off your first month of any Zencastr paid plan. I want you to have the same easy experience as we do for all of our podcasting and content needs. It's time to share your story.
So that's fascinating. So your book's coming out in this summer.
July 29th.
Nice.
July 29th. And it will be available for pre-order soon, and very soon, probably in a couple of months. And it will be not only a book, but I just found out an audio book. That made me super excited.
That's awesome.
Yes, it is.
Congratulations.
I'm excited. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. All right. So let's switch gears a little bit to the actual writing journey. So you wrote your first few books, and I know your memoirs were self-published, correct?
No.
Oh, they weren't. Okay. Okay.
I had a University of Missouri Press, because my grandfather was from Missouri. So there was a good connection, and that's how I, you know, that was my, and my very first book was textbook with the Berkeley Hess Press for textbooks.
Okay. And then your fiction was,
fiction was with the first three books were with a very small publisher called NL Publishing. And it wasn't self-published, but it was very small.
Okay.
And now I'm on Kensington, as you know, which is a much bigger, much better resourced outfit.
Okay. So how long have you been doing fiction?
Good question. I want to say maybe 2010.
Okay.
On and off. You know, I mean, each book takes like a year at least, you know. And I've taken time off in between books. One thing, because I was writing for the very small publisher, there was no one kind of putting my nose to the grindstone to say, we need the next book in 3 weeks or whatever. So I took my time. But I would say it's probably been 10 years at least, maybe more.
Yeah. So how do you feel about your writing journey? I feel like your energy, and I've known you for a while, your energy is so chill and you're just very like, yep, it's just going to happen the way it's going to happen kind of thing. Whereas I'm very like, oh my God, I've got to make it happen, which is not a good way to be. But talk to me about how you feel about your writing journey, where you hope it's going to go now that you're with Kensington and you have a bigger publisher and all of that good stuff.
Well, I have to say, because it has taken me so long, and the book that is coming out in July, I probably started writing that book maybe before the pandemic. So it's been a long birth, and it has gone through many iterations and revisions and millions of people reading it and da, da, da. And as you know, with writing, I've learned that's just part of the game. With music, music is a little bit different. If you're a performer, once you reach a certain level of expertise, you go to the gig, you sit down at the piano, you play the song, it comes out how it comes out, and then you walk away, they clap or they don't clap. And later you can tweak it, but it's not quite the same as writing. And that is something that I have had to learn, because every word you can argue about, the words, you can rearrange them endlessly. You can take things out. You can put things back in. You can, it's never done.
And it is, which is why a deadline's helpful, right?
Well, it has to be. It has to be. But that said, I feel pretty well satisfied. I feel like, as you know, to be published at all is an epic journey. I'm sure that many of your readers have gone through or are going through. It's a massive endeavor. And the sending out of the letters and the thing, I mean, it's a whole timus that goes on forever. And to finally have gotten not only a publisher, but a well-known publisher who is actually going to back the book and going to help me get it out and birth it in the world is enormously satisfying. I feel extremely grateful. So that's, I feel like I've hit my, you know, my stride, and I have on with this Psychics and Soul Food, I will do 3 books for sure. It may be that might be the end of it. We never know. But I will do 3 books, and then I think we'll all sit back and take a breath and see how it's going. But I'm excited about that. I'm excited about the opportunity to do 3 books in a series, develop this character whom I love and who I feel very close to. She's a psychic, but she's also a war widow trying to figure it out in a new life in a small town in southern Illinois, trying to make her way and deal with a lot of stuff. But she's plucky and really pretty sassy. So it's kind of a nice character, and I feel like I'm happy to stay with her for 3 books and see how things work out.
She sounds fabulous. At what point in your journey did you find an agent or start that search?
Well, that is a thing. I, like many of us, I went on a protracted search for years, and I finally got an agent like last year. I think basically last October, I signed with Lane Clark, and she immediately got busy and got me this deal with Kensington, for which I am so grateful. But it's all been new. You know, I'm not at all jaded to it. I'm still very excited because previously the other smaller publisher that I had, I was the one who went and got them, and I was the one who dealt with all the business issues or all the this and the that. So it feels very luxurious to be able to say, call my agent. I still like that one.
I know that does feel good, right?
Yeah, it does.
What was important to you in your agent? Like, what were you looking for from a relationship perspective?
Oh, okay. Well, good question. Since I'd never had one before, I wasn't that picky. But I did want someone. I was hopeful that I would be able to find a woman, and if possible, a Black woman. That felt really nice to be able to do that, because I know that there are not a whole lot of Black women in publishing, in the publishing industry. And I also thought it would help her understand my book. That said, I submitted to a few other Black agents who didn't get it at all. So it's no guarantee. But I felt what I really, I think, made me happy was that I did feel she got the book. She understood what I was trying to do. And when we had a conversation to sort of see whether we were going to be a good fit for each other, she made comments about the book that showed me, first of all, she was genuinely enthusiastic about it. And secondly, she understood what I was trying to do, which was to mesh history, accurate, you know, fairly accurate history with storytelling, and to kind of combine those two things. And I think she got that. And then she was able to convince my editor, and he gets it. So this makes me very happy, because, as you know, that's the most important thing. I've had things where I've shown pages to people. I'm sure this has happened to you or your listeners, where you go to a conference and you show your pages and the person looks at it and they just shake their head, and you can see that it's Greek to them. They don't get it. They're comparing it to some other author that you are not. And it's just not going to, you know, your ship's passing in the night. So, yeah, the fact that she got my book and that she was able to negotiate this deal for me, that feels huge. I know that if I had to negotiate my own deal, I would have probably been paid like $1 per book, you know, for the 3 books. And I would have been just so grateful to have been published at all. Thank you. Thank you. Can I please have some more? You know, yeah. I'd have been like that. And the fact that she was able to get a good deal and everything makes me feel, you know, very good.
Yeah. That's awesome. Congratulations. It is really so important, right? And I think a lot of people, and I didn't know this back when I first started, you know, I was kind of like that. I was like, oh, you want me?
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. I'll take whatever you want to give. Even
whatever
I had no idea.
Just tell me, you know, I'm happy. Tell me if I need to lick the floor.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
But, and I try to, you know, try to talk about this with newer writers, like, it's great to be grateful, but it's also important to recognize that it's a partnership and it's a business and it's your brand, and you have to watch out for yourself.
That is true. And you're a more of a business. You come to it from a more business perspective. So I'm sure you have greater wisdom than I did. But I will say, having spent, before I sold the book, having spent, you know, nearly 50 years in the music business, which is one of the scummier businesses on the face of the earth, I'm aware of how easily people can be taken advantage of, and how, because musicians are the same way. Oh, I can come and play in your club. Oh, thank you. Oh, you mean I have to pay to play in your club? Well, that's okay. I don't mind. I'll give you 90% of the door.
And yeah.
You know, I mean, this is the way we do.
Yeah.
Because it's very, very competitive and it's very, very hard. And what we're doing is so close to our heart and we so want to share that it's easy to just, you know, sort of sell ourselves short. So that is, I did have some familiarity from that perspective, you know, to yeah. bring.
Yep. Yeah. It's a wild business for sure.
Not for the faint of heart.
No.
And for those of you who are out there who may be trying to sell a book or whatever, I remember one time, I don't know if you know Bruce Cotton, do you know him?
Bruce Coffin?
Yes.
Yep.
And I remember, you know, despondently, I was somewhere at some conference and, you know, he's like a big author and sold a lot of stuff and all that. And he's also just really nice guy and he's really tall, right? And so I was like, and he said, you know, the most important tip. And I'm like, what? And he said, don't give up. Just don't give up. Be relentless. And I was like, yeah, that's, you have to. And sometimes you have to take a break. You know, you have to just, you know, after you've been rejected or kicked in whichever way we get kicked. Sometimes we have to just, you know, sit down and eat a box of chocolate and take a week or two and just, you know, cry in our pillow. But then we come back and we're just like, okay, I'm going to go through, maybe make some more edits, tweak it, and send it out again.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. It's definitely persistence.
It's a huge part of it.
Yeah. Okay, so now you have a deadline. So how has that changed your writing process?
Boy, I'm telling you, the good news is that as a musician and having worked in situations where you're working for other people or even as a teacher or, you know, you have to turn, I give deadlines all the time, but to actually have one. And Barb, who, of course, you know well, when I asked her about my current publishing situation, the main thing she said to me is, make your deadlines. Do not mess around with the deadlines. And I know in the music business, we're in the same thing. You know, it used to be you read these stories about the famous jazz musicians and they'd show up late to the gig or they'd be drunk or something. Nobody ever seemed to mind and they were still great jazz musicians. Well, today they would be fired and that would be it. They'd never be heard from again because there's so much competition. You just have to be businesslike. And I understand from their point of view that they have a schedule, they have stuff, and when you hold them back, you're backing them up. So I really try, and this is where also to ascribe to another tried and true cliche, better done than perfect. And I have had to say that to myself many times, even if I've turned in something, and I know that if I'd had another 3 weeks or month, I could have gotten it even better. I have to respect the fact that they also have a schedule and I have to trust that what I've turned in is good enough.
Yeah.
I'm hoping, you know.
Yeah.
Or if it really sucks, he will come back and tell me this stinks, do it again.
Yeah, he will too. I know, I had your editor for two of my series, okay. And I can agree with you wholeheartedly on the deadlines. He's very strict with them. Yeah. And also, he will tell you if it sucks.
Yeah. Well, and you need that. And
yeah. He should. That's his job, right?
Absolutely. You don't want something coming out. You mentioned our brand is writers. You don't want something coming out under your name and it's, you know, people go, oh, have you read the latest Carolyn Wilkins? Oh, I don't know. Yeah. I could only read the first page and then I had to put it away.
Yeah, nobody wants that.
No, we do not want that. Not at all.
No. But I have the same, a similar sticky note right on my computer. I'm looking at it right now. It says, done is better than good.
Done. Because you, other people are depending on you. It's not only up to you. And like you said, that's probably a good thing because otherwise, left to my own devices, I might sit there and polish it, go back and revise and then change and move the sentence around from as I walked into the room, I sneezed. No, I sneezed as I walked into the room. No. As I walked into, I could do that like all day, and yeah. He would never receive the thing. You
know? Yeah, and I also read somewhere. So I'm a little bit of a perfectionist, and I worry that you know, oh my gosh, it has to be as good as the last one, or it has to be better than the, you know, all of the things, right? Yeah. But I read somewhere, and I can't remember where, but it totally changed my perspective, and I'm gonna you know butcher how it was specifically said, but the gist of it was. To be a perfectionist is a little bit selfish because, first of all, you're depriving somebody of whatever you have to put out there because you're not putting it out there because you're being a perfectionist. But also, perfectionism is subjective.
Exactly. Because haven't you also turned in things that you thought were pretty perfect and received back? You know,
yeah.
I just sent in a manuscript and I thought I had gone through and purged all the typos. Well, no. Now there's a whole new list of things that need to be repaired. It's ongoing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So don't be a perfectionist. That's the headline, right? Just turn it in.
Just get it done.
Get it done. Well, this is exciting. I'm going to have you back when your book comes out so you can talk more about it because I'm excited for it and I really want people to read it. So we'll definitely have you back. But before I let you go, is there any advice that you would give to somebody who's just starting out on their fiction career?
Just starting writing at all?
Yeah.
I would say that the main thing is what we were just talking about, perfection. There's often a tendency, I remember when I first started writing, you know, you'd write your paragraph, then you'd go back and read it and go, that isn't quite it. Cross it out, write it again, cross it out. I would strongly encourage you, do not do that. Sit down like Lot's wife, right? In the Bible, don't look back. Just especially for the first draft, sit down and write. And every day, just write forward. Keep writing forward. Keep writing forward until you have spewed out the story that is on your heart in some form or fashion. And then when you have a rough thing, then go back and fix, because otherwise, if you try to go back and fix every paragraph after you've written it, you're never going to finish it. And you may get so discouraged that you just give up and you don't want to do that.
Agree. 100%. That's great advice. Thank you so much for being here. This was a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you so much, Liz. I enjoyed myself.
Awesome. We'll see you back here in the summer.
Great. Absolutely.
Okay, friends, that's Carolyn Wilkins. There were so many nuggets in here, right? I love what she said about keep writing forward and don't look back. It's such a great reminder. And I mean, you can take that literally in your current draft, just keep writing. Or you can just take that also to mean write a book, pitch it, let whatever happens, happens. Start writing another one, just keep going. And also, I love her reminders about persistence and resilience and how to keep your passion for storytelling. So I'd love to hear what you thought of this episode. Send me a message on Instagram and let me know, or head over to kateconti.com and send a message through my website. And if you could sign up for the show, subscribe to the podcast if you enjoyed it, I would love that. You wouldn't miss an episode. And if you liked it, if you could leave a rating and a review, that would be amazing. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.